Yeah, so first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers, Tim, Youngback, and Marcel, for inviting me to give this talk. The main message, let me actually first, before I get into the talk, thank my group members and collaborators. So Lei Yang is my graduate student, joined with Cheng Wang, who is a Perimeter faculty. And then Alex is my grad student as well, and Xuzhi Ying is a postdoc. So the main message of this talk is going to be that there exists a common framework to discuss topological properties of both ordinary metals and topological semi-metals. And I will explain what topological properties mean exactly. And so this is the outline of the talk. I will start with a brief introduction into metals and topological semi-metals, how they fit into how topological semi-metals in particular fit into the bigger picture. Then I'll talk about topological response of metals and semi-metals, and I'll explain that this can be expressed as generalized mixed anomalies of emergent symmetries in these systems. And then at the end, if there is time, I will talk about some potential interesting interaction effects that result from the interplay between interactions and anomalies. Okay? And so if you are interested in details, they are in these papers. So we know from basic solid-state physics that whether something is a metal or an insulator is determined basically by a single parameter, the number of electrons per unit cell per spin. Right? So I'll call this parameter nu. And so when this parameter is fractional, then we have a metal. So there is a Fermi surface of gapless excitations. And the volume of this Fermi surface, volume enclosed by this Fermi surface, divided by the volume of the brilliant zone, is precisely determined by the fractional part of this filling of the parameter nu. Okay? So this is true even in the presence of interactions, and so this statement is known as Leitinger's theorem. On the other hand, when nu is an integer, so then we have an insulator with no gapless excitations, or another possibility is an accidental semi-metal with equal-size electron and hole pockets. But for the purposes of my talk, this is the same thing as an insulator. It can be deformed into an insulator without changing the filling. Now, and so from this viewpoint, we can view metal as an intermediate phase between two insulators characterized by integer value of this Leitinger parameter nu. Okay? So any non-integer nu requires either gapless excitations in the form of Fermi surface, or so a Mott insulator is also possible, but this has to have topological order. Okay? And we cannot have just a trivial insulator. Okay, and so in the last few years, we've realized that there is another way a bulk metallic phase may arise. So there exists so-called topological semi-metals, which arise at integer nu, at integer value of the Leitinger parameter, as intermediate phases between insulators that correspond to the same nu, but have different electronic structure topology. Okay? So for example, a magnetic Weyl semi-metal may be viewed as intermediate phase between ordinary and integer quantum hole insulators in three dimensions. A non-magnetic Weyl semi-metal is an intermediate phase between ordinary and a three-dimensional time reversal invariant topological insulator. A type I, so-called Dirac semi-metal, is an intermediate phase between ordinary and topological crystalline insulator that's protected by rotational symmetry. And finally, a non-aligned semi-metal is an intermediate phase between ordinary insulator and also topological crystalline insulator, but protected by mirror symmetry. Okay? And so as I said, the main message of the talk is going to be that both ordinary metals and topological semi-metals may be characterized by topological response, which takes the form of a mixed anomaly involving symmetries characterizing these phases, such as charge conservation, spatial translation, rotation, et cetera. Okay, so let me start by explaining what this means on the simplest example of a one-dimensional metal. Okay, so suppose I have a spinless, for simplicity, one-dimensional metal, I'm going to always use the units where h bar equals c equals 1 throughout this talk. And so then I can express the Luttinger's theorem in this one-dimensional metal in the form of the following term in the imaginary time action. So A0 here is the temporal component of the electromagnetic gauge field. So nu is the filling, and A is the lattice constant, right? So A is the volume of the unit cell. This term, of course, does not look topological apart from the I in front. However, we may actually think of this as a topological term if we view the reciprocal lattice vector, 2 pi over A for this crystal, as a quote-unquote elastic gauge field. So let me explain what this means exactly. So we usually describe crystals in terms of periodic array of points in space, right? The Bravais lattice. However, you know that there is also a dual view of the crystal in terms of intersecting families of planes, okay, of crystal planes. And so these planes may be viewed as planes of constant phase, okay, so theta I, where, let's say, in three dimensions, I runs from 1 to 3, okay? Basically, theta I equal to 2 pi times an integer is an equation for these families of planes, okay? Now, in a perfect crystal, basically, these phases are just linear functions of position, and their gradients are equal to reciprocal lattice vectors of the crystal. And the solutions of this equation are the Bravais lattice points, okay? Now, imagine we have a distorted crystal, okay? So in this case, the gradients of these phases are no longer equal to the reciprocal lattice vectors of the undeformed crystal, but they may be viewed as local basis vectors of the reciprocal space, okay? So I'll call them EI mu. So the point is that these local basis vectors in the reciprocal space may be viewed as elastic gauge field in the sense that they encode topological properties of this crystal. So in particular, the two-form DEI determines the dislocation density. So if I take an integral of EI, in other words, around the closed loop in the crystal, this will tell me the number of dislocations that are piercing this loop. Circulation of EI around the ith cycle in the sample with periodic boundary conditions gives me the total number of unit cells along the ith direction. What I need to do basically is replace 1 over A by EX, let's say, if my one-dimensional crystal occupies the x-axis, okay? And then I can rewrite this as the following term that does look like a topological term. So it's I times nu, the prefactor is nu. It's just this number, the number of electrons per unit cell, and then EX veg A. And so there can be a time component of EX as well. That's just the time derivative of that phase, okay? I can get nu, the number of electrons per unit cell, by varying the section with respect to EX and A0. If I vary this with respect to the time component of the elastic gauge field, this is going to give me momentum in response to twisted boundary conditions, in response to the flux through the hole, basically, if I turn my one-dimensional metal into a circle, okay? Basically, the point of this rewriting of this as a topological term is basically to emphasize the topological properties which are of this one-dimensional metal, which are expressed by this number, the number of electrons per unit cell, and sort of hide or de-emphasize the non-topological, non-universal part, which is in this lattice constant. I don't want to think about the charge density. I want to think about the number of electrons per unit cell. That's invariant under small deformations. And so now the point is that I can connect now this topological response to the chiral anomaly. So let me explain how this works. So let me now focus only on the low energy states in this one-dimensional metal. So I have a left moving and a right moving mode at plus or minus kF, right? and kf is just proportional to nu in dimensionless units. So clearly, this if I just focus at low energy, we have the system has an enlarged emergent symmetry compared to the true microscopic symmetry of this one-dimensional metal. And this enlarged emergent symmetry corresponds to separate conservation of the right-handed and the left-handed electrons, right? So it's U1 left cross U1 right. And if we take this system, this symmetry literally, if we assume that this is the true microscopic symmetry, such a system cannot actually be realized on a one-dimensional lattice, but may only appear on the surface of a two-dimensional topological insulator, okay? So the theory of this topological insulator is this, right? So this is just a basically two time reversed two-dimensional Chorn insulators, right? And so then so we have a right and a left, which corresponds to the separate conservation of the left-handed and the right-handed electrons, and I can write this in terms of the electromagnetic gauge field A, which couples symmetrically to the left-handed and the right-handed electrons. And then the chiral gauge field, which I will write as the chiral gauge field, which I will call EX again, okay? And it couples anti-symmetrically to the left-handed and the right-handed electrons, and its charge is precisely the Fermi momentum, plus or minus KF, okay? So then, if I plug this in here, this is what remains, right? And if I integrate this in the presence of a boundary, I get the boundary theory, and this boundary theory looks exactly like what I wrote before, okay? And so in this sense, this action, the expressing the Luttinger theorem of a one-dimensional metal, may be viewed as a consequence of the chiral anomaly, okay? So of course, in reality, this system does exist in one dimension, right? And this is because the true symmetry of this system is not U1 left cross U1 right, but U1 cross Z, right? Where U1 is the charge conservation and Z is the translational symmetry, and this EX is not really a true U1 gauge field, but is this elastic gauge field, okay? Nevertheless, I mean, we can use this procedure to derive topological response in other cases, okay? So this reasoning can be generalized to any dimensions. Question? Well, basically because the translational symmetry here is not an internal symmetry, right? It involves actually shifting the lattice, and so that's not anomalous. Yes, that's an explanation. So I can generalize this to higher dimensions. So let's say we have a two-dimensional metal now. It has its Fermi surface is a one-dimensional line. And let's say this line is parameterized by parameter theta, which I can take to be from 0 to 2 pi, okay? And so the idea here is that we may view this theta as an extra dimension, okay? So this idea is originally due to Els, Thorgren, and Sentil, okay? And so as we know here, this system also has an enlarged emergent symmetry if we look only at low energies, which is the separate conservation of particle number at every point on the Fermi surface, right? So this is the basic result of Fermi liquid theory. And so therefore, the emergent anomaly in this case, higher dimensional, this enlarged symmetry also cannot be realized, if taken literally, cannot be realized in a purely two-dimensional system, right? It can only appear on the surface of a higher dimensional insulator, and the higher dimensional insulator in this case lives in five space-time dimensions. The plus one comes from the extra dimension that parameterizes the Fermi surface. So it's 2 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 5, okay? So the topological term I can write down in 4 + 1 dimension is this, right? This is just five-dimensional Chern-Simons term, okay? So I can again write this gauge field as a sum of electromagnetic field and now two elastic gauge fields whose charges are the components of the Fermi momentum parameterized by theta. Yes. Well, I'm not assuming anything, so in this case, I'm just following the same logic as in one dimension, right? So in this case, the emergent symmetry is separate conservation of particle number at every point on this Fermi surface. And I can think of this coordinate along the Fermi surface as an extra dimension. Okay? This is just a formal device to take into account all these points on the Fermi surface, right? In this case, it's not two discrete points like in one-dimensional case. It's a continuous coordinate. No, right? Because of the just like here, right? This preserves time reversal symmetry, right?
Oh, you have.
Yeah, you have. So here you just have a bunch of them. Here I just have a bunch of them that are parameterized by this parameter theta, right? Here this has additional ingredient. Now I also have gauge fields that have components in momentum space, in this theta space, and these are simply the components of the Berry connection in this case on the Fermi surface, okay? So if I integrate around the Fermi surface, integrate over this parameter theta, then this is what remains. Yes, you have a question? Well, so my original system is in two dimensions, right? Plus one theta, plus one time, plus one extra dimension, since this can only exist on the surface of a plus one dimensional topological insulator. If the symmetry is literally what I'm talking about, the conservation of particle number on at every point on the Fermi surface. So this is what remains. This is a non-zero part if I integrate over theta, and if I integrate this again in the presence of a boundary, this is what I get. And the parameter nu is again just the relative volume of the Fermi surface relative to the volume of the Brillouin zone, and this is how it arises here. Okay, and so this gives me the Lachenger theorem basically in a two-dimensional metal. Okay, so now let's generalize this to topological semimetals. So let's start. Yeah.
So, what about translational symmetry?
Well, yeah. So the translational symmetry is expressed by the fact that I have these translation. These are the another way I can call them is translation gauge fields. Yeah. So translational symmetry, I guess, is important here. So I have a well-defined number of electrons per unit cell.
So I'm trying to see whether this approach can be connected to this Oshikawa.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. Just for metals, this is the same thing, just told in a different way. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you can, in fact, as I mentioned in one of the first slides, you can obtain the momentum, in response to flux, right, by varying the section with respect to the time component of the elastic gauge field, and that's precisely the Oshikawa's argument. let's look at magnetic wild semimetal, which is the simplest one with just two nodes. One left-handed, one right-handed. So this system exists at integer value of nu, right? So the Lachenger, this Lachenger anomaly is absent in this case. Okay, the what's going to play the role of the Lachenger parameter in this case will actually be the Hall conductivity. So this has an anomalous Hall conductivity that's proportional to the distance between the wild nodes. Okay. And so this is what's going to play the role of the parameter nu, okay? So by the same logic as before, we have an enlarged, if I only look at low energies, I have an enlarged symmetry corresponding to separate conservation of the right-handed and the left-handed electrons. So again, U1 left cross U1 right. And again, if I take this literally, this may only be realized on the surface of a four plus one dimensional topological insulator with this action. So this is basically just a sum of two time reversed quantum Hall actions in 4 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so again, I write the right-handed and the left-handed fields as electromagnetic one plus the elastic or the translation gauge field with the charge that's given by the momentum location of the wild points, so plus or minus Q. Okay, so there is another way actually to derive this here, and that connects to nicely to the previous story. So, and this basically shows that this whole procedure is logically consistent. So instead of starting from a pristine wild semi metal where the Fermi energy coincides with the nodes, I can consider slightly doped wild semi metal. Okay. So in this case, I have two Fermi surfaces, each enclosing a left-handed or a right-handed node. Okay, so this is a three-dimensional metal, right? And so I can, using the same logic as before, connect this now to a seven-dimensional topological insulator. Okay, and what I need to use here is that the integral of the Betti curvature, right, curl of the Betti connection, around each of these pieces of the Fermi surface is equal to plus or minus 2 pi, whether it's a right-handed wild node or a left-handed wild node. And so integrating this over the Fermi surface gives me back precisely what I wrote here. So it's all consistent. And then if I further integrate this in the presence of a boundary, this gives me this action now. In three dimensions, or in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So this parameter lambda in front, so this is just the ratio of the separation between the wild points to the size of the brilliant zone in the z direction, okay? And so what this action expresses is precisely basically the whole conductance per atomic plane that's fractional, that's given by lambda over 2 pi. So this cannot exist in a simple insulator, and that's why you have to have gapless modes, basically. So again, a fractional value of this parameter lambda requires gapless modes in the form of wild nodes. Now, so there is another important effect that's contained in this action. So imagine I insert a 2 pi magnetic flux tube in the z direction, right? So then basically this dA is going to be equal to 2 pi along this flux tube. And so then I get the following action that describes that flux tube, okay? And that's actually, you can recognize this as the action of a one-dimensional metal with Leichinger parameter lambda, okay, with charge lambda per unit cell. So what this expresses is this well-known fact that the wild semi-metal has a special zeroth Landau level that basically crosses the wild points and behaves like a one-dimensional metal with Leichinger volume lambda, with Leichinger volume determined by the separation between the wild points. Okay? And so this is behind the existence of this Landau level is behind a lot of the interesting experimentally observed properties of wild semi metals, like negative magnetoresistance and so on. At least it's claimed to be. So we can also generalize this, of course, to time reversal invariant wild semi metal. So in this case, the minimal model contains 4 wild nodes, right, left, left, right, and let's take them all to be on the z-axis for simplicity. Okay. So I can follow exactly the same logic. So in this case, this is the action for the four-dimensional topological insulator. It contains 4 contributions for each of the wild points. Okay, and so then this is the after following through the same procedure. This is the action that I get that describes this time reversal invariant while semi-metal. So in this case, there is only one A that's present in here, so there is nothing like Hall effect, right? There is no purely electromagnetic topological response because this preserves time reversal invariance. But there is an analog of one-dimensional metal on a flux line, except the flux line here is the flux line of the translation gauge field. And what this describes is basically a screw dislocation with a Burgers vector along the z direction. So what this tells me is that such a screw dislocation binds a one-dimensional metal, again, with charge lambda per unit cell, where lambda is related to the parameters of to the locations of the wild points in this way. Okay. Let me skip that actually. So let me move on to probably the most interesting and the most non-trivial case that may not be. So what I've talked about so far, a lot of you probably have seen before, but this is perhaps something newer. So let's look at non-aligned semi-metal. Okay, so in this case, this is a system where we have touching of two non-degenerate bands in three dimensions, but this touching is not does not occur at discrete points, but along a line, along a one-dimensional line in momentum space. In addition to translational symmetry, there has to be another symmetry that protects that. And so in this case, this is mirror symmetry. It's mirror symmetry with respect to a plane that contains that non-align. Okay. And it's also a topologically non-trivial state, and this is expressed by the fact that there are surface states, the so-called drumhead surface states, that basically fill the projection of this nodal line onto the surface Brillouin zone. Okay, in this picture, that drumhead surface state is exactly flat. Now, in principle, so this is not the flatness is not protected by any real symmetry. It arises in a particular model due to artificial chiral sublattice symmetry. Okay. So in principle, it's not flat, but what I will talk about will not depend on the flatness, but it's easier to understand if I assume that the state is flat. So I will assume it's flat, but bear in mind that what I'll talk about does not actually depend on it, okay? Okay, so again, I can use exactly the same logic. So let's say this is my nodal line. Okay, now this looks exactly like the picture of a Fermi surface of a two-dimensional metal, right? But the difference here is that, unlike in this case, the whole space, the embedding space, is three-dimensional. Okay, and so therefore the topological term is not going to live in 4+1 or 5 space-time dimensions. It's going to live in 6 dimensions, so 3+1+1+1. So again, the emergent symmetry here is the separate particle conservation at every point along this nodal line. Okay, so that symmetry cannot be, if taken literally, cannot be realized in a three-dimensional system. It can only exist on the surface of this six-dimensional topological insulator. Okay, and so because this is six-dimensional now, not five-dimensional, the topological term does not look like a Chern-Simons term. It looks like a theta term, right? So it's dA, 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 right? And this parameter theta is equal to plus or minus pi, and this is quantized to plus or minus pi by the mirror symmetry that protects the nodal line, yes. It's closed, yeah, it must be closed, yeah. Yeah, it cannot be an open arc, of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, it can be open, of course, but in that case, it has to span the whole Brillouin zone, and then we will have at least two lines, right? So if it's one line, it has to be closed. Okay? So, and Well, so I again use the same procedure that I used for a two-dimensional metal, except now for this six-dimensional topological term. So I can parameterize the nodal line by a parameter phi that goes from 0 to 2 pi. Now, another consistency check here is that just like in the case of Weyl semimetal, this can also be obtained from the seven-dimensional chiral anomaly term if I assume that this nodal line semimetal is slightly doped. Okay, so in this case, there is a Fermi surface, a toroidal Fermi surface that encloses another line. And the fact that I can use here is that the circulation of the beta curvature around any loop that encloses this nodal line is equal to plus or minus pi. And that's how I get from this seven-dimensional Chern-Simons term to six-dimensional theta term. So if I integrate over phi, this is what I get in the end. And integrate then in the presence of a boundary, this is what I get. So this is the topological response that describes the nodal line semimetal. So the VF here, so this is the volume or area in momentum space enclosed by this nodal loop, okay? But it does not look, of course, like the topological response of a 2D Fermi liquid, which would be EX, EY, EYA, right? This is EX, EYDA, because again, I have the embedding space is three-dimensional rather than two-dimensional. And so what this describes is basically this. So it's spontaneous, meaning existing in the absence of any electric field, electric polarization, which is given by the coefficient of this term. So plus or minus the area of the enclosed by another loop divided by 8 pi squared, okay? Now, if I imagine expanding this nodal loop, right, to the boundaries of the Brillouin zone, then it can disappear and a gap can open. So in this case, I get a mirror symmetry protected topological crystalline insulator. And so in this case, VF is just equal to the area of the section of the Brillouin zone, 2 pi squared, and this polarization is plus or minus a half, so which corresponds precisely to the response of a crystalline insulator protected by mirror symmetry, right? So this is the basically the only non-trivial value of the polarization, plus or minus a half, that an insulator can have. This sort of fractional value that's not equal to an integer or a half requires gapless modes again in the form of another line. This also gives us an important insight about what exactly is anomalous about the surface state of this drum head surface state of another line semimetal. So if I integrate this in the presence of a boundary, this is the action that I get that describes the nodal line, the drum head surface state, okay? And you see that what this looks like, this looks very similar to the action that describes a two-dimensional Fermi liquid, except the coefficient here is a half of what it should be in a two-dimensional Fermi liquid, okay? Basically, the way to express what is anomalous about the drum head surface state of a nodal line semimetal, it's basically a two-dimensional Fermi liquid, but which violates Lysenger theorem. It's a two-dimensional Fermi liquid in which the actual charge density on the surface that's given by this coefficient does not match the volume that's enclosed by the projection of the nodal line onto the surface Brillouin zone. And the difference is precisely the polarization, okay? Well, the way to see this basically is to either add an infinitesimal mirror symmetry breaking term that's gonna open a gap and move the these drumhead surface states either above or below the Fermi energy, depending on the sign of the mirror symmetry breaking term, or just simply without any mirror symmetry breaking term, move the Fermi energy slightly above and slightly below the zero, slightly above or slightly below the location of the nodal line, and actually calculate the charge. The charge density on the surface in these two cases, and you see that it does not match the Luttinger volume, and the difference is the bulk polarization. Okay.
If you consider bulk, it's okay.
Sorry?
If you consider both boundaries.
Yeah, if you consider both boundaries, I guess. Well, so see, so if I again, if I add the mirror symmetry breaking term, then the surface state on one boundary is going to move up, on the other boundary is going to move down, right? So it's still well defined in this sense, yeah. Okay. Okay. So I do have a little bit of time. So let me just very briefly talk about interactions. So basically, the question we can ask is the following. So is there a fully gapped symmetric insulator with the same topological response, right? So this question has been asked in the case of metals, right? So you can ask, given a metal with some a fractional number of electrons per unit cell, can I create a mod insulator that does not break symmetries, right? And so this question has been answered, and so we know that you get topological order of certain kinds in this case, topological order that depends on the number of electrons per unit cell. And we can ask the same question for topological semimetals, right? And by the same logic as in metals, if such a state exists, it cannot be trivial. It must have topological order. And this is probably the most interesting question in the case of magnetic wild semimetals, because in this case, such a state would be a three-dimensional analog of a fractional quantum Hall effect, or fractional quantum Hall liquid. As I have basically this fractional conductivity, Hall conductivity per atomic plane, but it's an insulator. Okay? This cannot exist in an ordinary insulator. And so we've answered this question. And so basically, this chiral anomaly of a magnetic wild semimetal does turn out to be consistent with a gapped fractionalized state, but only at one particular value of the wild node separation, namely when it's exactly half a reciprocal lattice vector. Okay, so let me just very briefly explain to you why this can exist only at half the reciprocal lattice vector. So imagine I take a non-interacting or a weakly interacting wild semimetal. So in this case, we know that the projection of the wild points onto the surface brilliant zone are connected by this Fermi arc. Right? Now imagine I gap the wild points. Okay. Without breaking symmetry, so without resizing the brilliant zone. What it means is that this Fermi arc now is just left hanging there, right? And this cannot happen, of course. It cannot just end like that at arbitrary points in the brilliant zone, okay? Now, the only way out of this, and this seems to say that basically gapping without broken symmetry is impossible. However, the only way out of this is if you split the Fermi arc into two Majorana states, right? Because Majorana is half a complex fermion. And if that Majorana state spans the whole brilliant zone, then this can be done. And obviously, this can be done only when, because Majorana, again, is exactly half a complex fermion, this can only be done when the separation between the wild points is half the size of the brilliant zone, okay? So this state that one gets, the way you can get this is basically inducing a topological P plus IP superconductivity in a wild semimetal. This gaps the wild points and creates this chiral Majorana mode that spans the whole brilliant zone. Okay. The way then we can obtain an insulator is by disordering the superconductor proliferating vortices while keeping the pairing gap. Okay? So doing this is non-trivial, of course, because these vortices are non-trivial. They carry gapless modes in their core. So in particular, the basic superconducting vortex, flux pi, or hc over 2e, carries Majorana mode. That's a consequence of the fact that you have Majorana H state. The double vortex, the flux 2 pi, does not carry a Majorana mode, but it actually carries charge a half per unit cell by the same argument as before. Okay? And so the smallest vortex that we can condense is actually flux 4 pi. Okay? And so this, by the usual arguments, this implies that this state has topological order, Z4 topological order, this charge fractionalization. So basically, the quasiparticles are charged half bosons and fermions. And in addition to quasiparticle excitations, we have these vortex loop excitations, okay, that either carry Majorana modes upon intersecting an atomic plane, or charge a half semions. Okay. So since I am basically out of time, let me just say one more thing. So basically, you know, the reason why you can be skeptical that fractional quantum Hall effect can be generalized to three dimensions is because, as you know, anions are an essential feature of 2D. Quantum Hall effect, and they can only exist in two dimensions, right? So the way out here is that basically there are these vortex loop excitations, and their intersections with atomic planes behave precisely as anions. Okay, so that's why a generalization of quantum Hall effect is possible to three dimensions. And so for the experts in the audience, this state is very closely related to the pH Pfaffian state that you can get by gapping a massless 2D Dirac fermion without breaking and keeping the whole conductivity E squared over 2H. And it's also closely related to the topologically ordered states that people have looked at on the surface of topological insulator. Okay, so this is basically a three-dimensional version of that. Yeah. Well, right. So in this case, I guess it's a three-loop braiding where you have to look at braiding of two vortex loops in the presence of a dislocation line. So I think if you look at three loop braiding in this case, then it looks basically exactly analogous to the two dimensional braiding, right? So basically, again, intersections of these vortex loops, these planes, just behave as two dimensional anions. Yeah. Okay. So let me stop here, and thanks for your attention.
Okay, thank you for a very interesting talk. This talk is open to questions and comments. Yep, go ahead. I think you can use this. I can. I'm not very good at.
Yeah, so yeah, thank you, great talk. So the other story I've heard about how to gap out a Weyl semi-metal is this charge density wave story.
Right.
It seems like kind of the two options you are presenting is kind of breaking and restoring U1 to get topological order. Do you think there's something similar you can do by breaking and restoring?
Yeah, so yeah, you can do that as well. So you can, again, start from the same Weyl semimetal with Weyl nodes separated by half reciprocal lattice vector. So gap it by a charge density wave. So in this case, charge density wave order parameter is going to be Ising-like, right? And you can look at domain walls. So domain wall is going to host a gapless 2D Dirac fermion, okay? And then that's exactly the connection, actually, to the 2D story, right? You can now gap those 2D Dirac fermions and stack them, and then you get this state.
Great, thank you.
Okay, any other question? So for the nodal semi metal, like more conventional explanation for the from head state, just like if you take a one dimensional.
Right, and then again, there is polarization.
That's
yeah.
right. Then, that's right. Then, you know, it's like having a boundary.
It's like a sushi for Higgins.
Yeah, in the
right.
guitar
that's
chain,
right.
then
right.
inside the ring, get this.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Outside is.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
It's
yeah.
the same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
All right, so if there's no other question, I'd like to thank Anton for a great talk.